Thank you. Thank you, Morena. Why provide a separate chapter? And sorry, before I start, just to clarify, this is some supplementary evidence, and as you know, I was observing some of the evidence in questioning last week, and I'm trying to assist the process by just reflecting on those and thinking further about my evidence in chief. So why provide a separate chapter? I am not aware of any evidence providing strong rationale why chapter 39 is required as a standalone chapter. In my opinion, integrating the provisions set out in chapter 39 into other parts of the PDP provides a more holistic and integrated planning approach. And I've given a footnote to the reference of my evidence in chief where I give examples of how the rules could be allocated throughout other chapters of the PDP. I would support provision of a separate chapter if it is the only location in the PDP where mana whenua values are directly addressed. However, that is not the case, as provisions implementing Chapter 5 are dispersed throughout the PDP. Identification and extent of mana whenua cultural values and mapping. I remain unclear on whether or not the Wahi Tipuna mapping identifies all of the mana whenua cultural values that need to be considered when identifying or evaluating the impacts of an activity on mana whenua cultural values. But I will rely on the evidence of Mr. Allison, Mr. Higgins or Ms. Carter in respect of this matter. I maintain my opinion that the proposed planning regime will create uncertainties and unknown risks and costs associated with implementing the provisions if the maps do not correctly identify all the mana whenua cultural values. I remain unclear if the mapping of Wahi Tipuna areas around statutory acknowledgement areas are intended to capture the same extent of area, or whether they intended to be different. My assumption is that they are intended to be different, but this is not explicitly stated in the PDP. Providing more certainty. I maintain more certainty should be provided in the policies or methods for policy 39.2.1.3 to be practically workable and appropriate. If policy 39.2.1.3 is intended to relate only to the known threats in Schedule 39.6, then the policy should state this. And I believe that's what Mr. McClellan was talking about this morning for ORC. If policy 39.2.1.3 is intended to capture other activities, then the policy framework is incomplete, and consideration should be given to deleting Schedule 39.6 altogether. I maintain the PDP should provide criteria or guidance for determining significance in the context of policy 39.2.1.3. I maintain it is important for the district plan regime to clearly specify or articulate the cultural values of mana whenua, or at a minimum prescribes criteria or processes for identifying these values and determining the significance of the potential adverse effects. Failure to do this will likely result in uncertainty and inconsistent implementation of the provisions. I am not aware of evidence from QLDC or Mana Whenua clarifying how the consultation or CIA review processes will occur in practice. While mana whenua are being represented in this matter by Okaha, it is unclear what role Tront and TAMI will have in the implementation or administration of the PDP once it becomes operative. My understanding is O'Kaha will not act on behalf of Trant or Tammy, but I'm unclear if the framework being promoted requires all three entities to be engaged. Process recommendations. To help decision-making processes, including this plan development matter and future resource consent applications, in my opinion, the following from Mr. Allison, Mr. Higgins, or Ms. Carter would be of assistance. A. What are the resource management outcomes Mana Whenua seek from the proposed district plan? Can the proposed district plan prescribe the processes or criteria required for achieving those outcomes? If not, why not? B. What is the rationale for permitting development in urban zones but not rural or settlement zones? Will treating them differently undermine the intended purpose of Chapter 39? C. Are the maps comprehensive, complete in respect of satisfactorily capturing all Mana Whenua cultural values? Or do other Mana Whenua cultural values exist? If the latter, then why map Wahi Tupuna areas? D. Are the scheduled threats comprehensive, complete in respect of satisfactorily capturing all activities that threaten Mana Whenua cultural values? Or can other activities threaten Mana Whenua cultural values? If the latter, then why list specific activities as threats? I also believe it would be helpful to understand the extent, if any, to which Mana Whenua landscape values may be picked up in the Stage 1, Topic 2 Landscape Value Identification Workstream QLDC is undertaking. That's what Ms. Baker Galloway was talking about this morning. Some recommended provisions. I recommend that Mana Whenua, in the first instance, develop plan provisions which seek to provide more prescriptive guidance or criteria to help applicants and decision makers determine what might be significant adverse effects on Mana Whenua cultural values in the context of Policy 39.2.1.3, and set out consultation and CIA review procedures or protocols to be applied when implementing the provisions. I would support a direction from you that parties or planning experts be given an opportunity to test such guidance criteria, for example, by way of expert conferencing. Avoiding resource consents where APA is provided. I'll read that. I have opined previously that if the law allows, there should be no need for a resource consent application in circumstances where Mana Whenua have provided their written approval. Ms. Baker Galloway has suggested a potential lawful way of achieving this through application of Section 87BB. 88BB, sorry. In my opinion, this approach could be applicable and very appropriate. For example, if APA is provided by Mana Whenua, then the criteria can be achieved. And Mr. Robinson, I've given you some planning evidence, 1, 2, 3, 4, in those ticks, which I'm happy to be tested and taken through those, which sets out those criteria, which I say. Activities which require resource consent for breaching the Wahi Tupuna permitted rules and no other related consent triggers can be interpreted as a marginal non-compliance with the Wahi Tupuna rules. This is on the basis that if no other district plan rules is triggered, then resource consent for non-marginal, sorry, on the basis that other district plan rules would trigger resource consent for non-marginal compliances. Adverse effects of activity can be interpreted as being no different in character, intensity, or scale than they would be in the absence of the non-marginal compliance. Adverse effects of activity on a person will be deemed to be less than minor and disregarded. and Kia Ora Sea can apply its discretion to notify the person proposing to undertake the activity. Kia Ora Sea could establish protocols for specifying the circumstances where Section 87BB will be applied. In my opinion, it would be appropriate to set out these circumstances in a district plan policy or method, and I provided some potential wording there as a starting point for your and others' consideration. In conclusion, adoption of a permitted activity framework where APA from specified mana whenua is provided, coupled with clarity over the uncertainty raised in my paragraphs from 14-15 above, including prescriptiveness about consultation and CIA review procedures and development of a significance criteria, should address my and Wayfair's concerns.
Cheryl, thank you for that. Few brief points arising out of supplementary that you've tabled. In terms of the first question about whether Wade, Puna and statutory acknowledgement areas are exactly coincident, I think the discussion we had this morning with Ms. Brian's book suggests that they're not.
Yes.
Some of them may be, but clearly at least that one isn't, and is clearly addressing something different. But more generally, you said, paraphrasing, if Chapter 6, if Schedule 39.6 isn't complete, you should junk it. If there are other things that fall outside it, and I want to test that. The cri de coeur through the submission evidence is a desire for greater specificity, greater information. Is it better to provide what information you can, even if it's not completely comprehensive?
In my opinion, not if there are still gaps or potential for substantial gaps in the information and matters, because it almost becomes, or potentially risks becoming, a folly in that.
Say that again, potentially risking.
Becoming a folly, potentially. Because practitioners, myself included, and landowners will be of. Well, the plan will represent a signal that says, these are the threats, these are the issues, you deal with them, you're fine, in respect of addressing mana whenua cultural values.
Is it ever going to be possible to identify every possible threat if you have perhaps in a rural zone new innovative technologies or tourism ventures or things being set up? Is it going to be possible for mana whenua to always identify potential threats?
I wouldn't have thought so, but that's why I'm relying on the evidence of Kaumātua on that point.
Are you requesting or suggesting that all effects on mana whenua values should only be addressed through this chapter, rather than?
Well, that's the question that I'm posing. That the having a chapter with the schedules of values and threats signals or suggests that these are the issues and these are the activities that need to be managed, full stop. It's not clear to me that that is what is intended by the plan, and it comes. I just struggle to understand how it actually benefits everybody in terms of plan implementation if there's particular direction around certain areas, but then there is still potentially various other unknown values adverse effects, threats and activities, that'll still be captured by other provisions in the plan.
So you're a planning practitioner in this book here. What, in you know, your experience, what level of engagement occurs now with Mana Whenua across where these issues are dealt with through multiple or through various different sections?
In my experience, I'd say considerable, where there's discretion to do so. As a particular example, you may or may not be interested in, and there's a personal element to this, where I reside in Punitapu or Bob's Cove has been subdivided for rural residential. That, I understand, went through a reasonably or comprehensive consultation process with engagement of mana whenua, identification of mana whenua issues, and a resolution to those issues by way of implementation of the subdivision. It was all under the operative plan. Where there is breaches to setbacks from water bodies, for example, there is typically, or at least in my experience, often an ability for council to identify Runanga as affected parties.
I suppose the $1 million question would be, is that actually happening?
And I can't speak on behalf of, obviously, Ngāi Tahu as to whether that is happening to an appropriate extent.
Raising the landscape value identification work stream is something that we're caucusing underway or about to get underway. Are you aware, are there any cultural experts involved in that process? We'll have to find that out.
No, there are not. There are landscape experts involved who will be very familiar with best practice and including the identification of mana whenua values, but no cultural experts that I'm aware of.
Mr. Farrell, going back to your supplementary, you say 14B, what's the rationale for fitting development in urban zones but not rural and settlement zones? The settlement zone is treated as a rural urban zone for this purpose.
Sorry, the settlement zones are treated as
urban zone for this purpose.
Okay, thank you.
And so will treating them differently undermine the intended purpose of Chapter 39? I couldn't help but think when you said that, isn't that exactly what the plan does for Owen Hills? Has one treatment for Owen Hills in the rural zone and another treatment for Owen Hills outside the rural zone?
There are no Owen Hills outside the rural zone.
Correct. No Owen Hills identified on the face of the plan outside the rural zone. There are clearly O&Ls, for instance, in the section 6 says, and as I understand, as it's been explained to us, that's the principle underlying the carve out of the exception that's been worked out in the environment court at the moment. That's
well, I have a different understanding.
Well, you better tell me what your understanding is, because that's quite interesting.
Yeah. And so, sorry to cut across. So I guess to digress to exception zones for a little bit, and happy to tease this out further when it comes to rural visitor zone evidence. My recollection, the beginning of the discussion around exception zones comes from His Honour Judge Jackson, the Topic 1 hearing, which I was part of, providing planning evidence. And it was focused on rural zones, existing rural development zones, effectively.
Rural with a small R or a capital R? Because there are a number of rural zones, but there is only one rural zone.
Small R. So existing sub-zones and development zones, if I can call them that, within the within the R&L. So it was...
Well, does it apply to existing rural residential and rural lifestyle zones, for
example? Yes. So it was my understanding was the genesis was intended to acknowledge that with the PDP, which is a new plan, or reviewing the operative plan, that there are existing development rights, effectively, or expected development anticipated in the planning regime. And one method for reconciling how to deal with the strategic landscape provisions for ONLs, how to reconcile potentially some strong conflicts with how those existing or anticipated development rights might pan out, was to exclude them from those strategic provisions. That is my recollection of the genesis of those exception zones, which is now 1 or 2 years later being articulated in evidence and before the court.
Okay, well...
So, sorry I digress, but...
No,
I hope that helps.
Go back to where I started, which is... It's still the same question. If you take the analogy of ONLs, landscape architects will tell you where they are. The zones do not coincide with them. As you say, there are exceptions. Like we'll have the discussion about exactly what an exception means. The rural visitor zone is probably more capsa, because this is just an analogy. But effectively, you've got the same principle. You've got an exception, certainly for urban areas, from ONL provisions. But why would it doesn't undermine the ONL provisions? Why would excluding the urban provisions undermine the Mana Whenua provisions?
Well, and that's why it poses a question, because I'm unclear as to what the intent of Mana Whenua, or the expectation is around the chapter and the provisions. So, effectively, I'm saying I'm unclear on what the intended outcome is. And I think you could probably only answer, my evidence is that it's not really possible to determine if it does or does not undermine that outcome until there's clarity over what that outcome is. And for example, if the outcome is purely effects of development on the resource, and if the evidence of Ngāi Tahu is that in urban areas, there will be no inappropriate adverse effects on the mana whenua cultural values, then that would help explain the exclusion and its appropriateness.
They do give evidence on that matter, Mr. Ellison, I think, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah, about the level of modification that's already occurred in urban areas and how it's so modified that additional modification is a marginal change, I suppose, something like that. Mm. But it's in their evidence.
Mm. Okay.
And I think the other thing that's in their evidence is that the fact that it is modified doesn't mean that there are no mana whenua values in those areas. But what they're saying is they're not suggesting that the rules would apply, just the objectives and policies, so that if you were a full discretionary or non-apply activity for some other reason, those values could then be brought to bear, but not otherwise. That's as I understand how Kaitaua was suggesting it be applied.
Mm.
And so I'm not saying that that should be treated as gospel, but assuming my understanding is correct, what's your view then?
Sounds like a good place or good rationale potentially for a marginal non-compliance outside urban zones, where if I'm hearing that other consent triggers will pick up potentially significant adverse effects that then warrant consideration of the objectives and policies.
And in terms of your discussion about what is marginal, what isn't, isn't it always going to be a scale and degree issue? That the scale, degree, and specific location, that you're digging a hole, it may have no impact on mana whenua values, or it may have significant adverse effects, or it may have something in between, depending on the specific location. If you're digging a large hole, the specific location may not matter. You're still making an impact on the landscape.
But the landscape effect is not the, or question, is the landscape effect the concern, the adverse effect?
Well,
or is it the value which, in the circumstance I'm talking about, being potentially disregardable or, as a scale, acceptable to mana whenua as demonstrated by the APA?
I think it's nice to use landscape and again, I'd use it with a small L. You could equally say the land. You're digging a hole, you're making an impact on the land. If it's a big enough hole, and rather, like, landscape has connotations, particularly in this district, of what the landscape architect's art. But as I say, going back, that how can you identify in advance that it's marginal when it may be large, it may be small, it may be something in between? Is it marginal in the sense of just another area of control? Is that what you're suggesting in your Rule 910, that you're interpreting marginal in the context of 87BB as being just one, basically like a... that's the one that trips you over, rather than the scale of the effect?
I guess what I'm trying to... Well, what I understand could happen is it could be interpreted as a marginal non-compliance if the interpretation follows the rationale that it's what mana whenua determine, as opposed to a pure physical scale of adverse effect.
Final questions. It seemed to me, while I was left wondering reading your evidence in chief, whether you'd considered the implications of the policies in Chapter 3 relating to our mana whenua values, in particular the direction to avoid significant adverse effects.
I hadn't paid attention, close attention to those particular provisions. But I'm certainly not suggesting that those effects should not be avoided. I'm merely, my evidence is about trying to help articulate what is significant or what might be considered significant.
And in that regard, I come back to, isn't it always going to be a scale and degree and location? Like me, you will have read 100 cases that are all saying it all depends on the facts. And a specific situation. And are the kind of criteria ever going to be better than it depends?
Yes, I think they can be. I think we're getting now, in terms of plan development, where prescription is appropriate, and I gave the example in my evidence in chief of the natural hazards policy, where and it was Wayfair was involved, and I was there assisting Wayfair. Same issue. There was a policy around avoiding significant effects or significant risk. And there was nothing beyond that to assist decision makers and plan administrators how to apply that in practice. And as a result of mediation, a significance criteria was developed and embedded in the plan. Now, it just helps frame the discussion and narrow the potential issues, I think, and it's helpful. And I think it's worth doing, because I do think it will certainly reduce uncertainties and costs and associated risks.
Well, in that particular example, the major uncertainty was the concept of tolerability, without saying tolerable to whom or on what basis.
And it followed through that there was also, I recall, some policy guidance or criteria around what is tolerability and how to determine that.
Now, the 42, your paragraph 42, you've got to be careful. Lawyers submit, Mr. Farrell, planning experts opine. CIA is neither appropriate or necessary in all circumstances. Seems to me that Mr. Bathgate agrees with you, because he's suggesting to turn the policy around. So it's so to say a CIA may be required depending on the effects. Are you in the same?
I think so.
Am
yes.
Am I reading you both as being in the same space?
I believe so. Yes. And thank you for the comment about submit.
Classic cheap shot and cross.
Especially when he does quite a lot of the pining as well.
Yes, exactly. Commissioner Cheatham, have you sorted out?
Well, you've asked one of them, but that's fine. Just while we're on that, your original evidence in chief, your final paragraph there, 45. Talked about an option being to allow applicants to provide their own assessment of effects on the Manapena cultural values. How do you think that would be appropriate?
On the so that's an aspiration, I guess, that I'm saying there, that if the plan helps direct and articulate better what the issues actually are, then in my opinion it'll become a matter of practice, or it could become a matter of practice, that applications could be treated like for like. And if you have a similar, if you have an application for minor earthworks, for example, that was approved subject to certain conditions, and that became a reoccurring theme, that conditions, or if it unfolds in practice that certain conditions appropriately address effects on mana whenua, then it could be appropriate for independent experts who are not qualified in doing cultural impact assessments to provide an assessment that is sufficient to sufficiently address the concerns in a like-for-like situation.
So that would be in a scenario where you had gotten to such a level of prescription where you had potentially a template or a checklist, checkbox type exercise that person would go through. Is that what? Is that where you're going to with that?
No, well, it's a good question. Certainly not to begin with. It's not a tick-the-box exercise to begin with, but as the over years, and we're talking 10 to 20 years potentially around this planning regime, what it will become, I expect there will become standard practice as how best to deal with resource consent applications and CIAs in this district. And what my evidence is saying there is that what I'd understood from Ms. Pickard's evidence, that it needs to be a proper indentation, independent assessment from an expert in cultural impacts, a proper report. Whereas I don't think that is probably going to be necessary in every single case.
But I think if there was assessment or evaluation required of mana whenua values, or more, perhaps more detailed site-specific evaluation than what we might have with a wahi tupuna overlaying that information, surely that would require mana whenua expertise.
Well, I'd take that back to what extent is or are mana whenua values and threats identified in the plan and the policy framework, and to what extent has there been further thought or evidence in terms of cases and decisions that might be applicable to that location.
Mr. Bellock, two or three for me. Just going to your summary or supplementary statement, paragraph 12, you say that maintaining the plan should provide criteria or guidance for improvements in the context of that avoid policy. Two questions arising from it. And on its face, somehow, I think not just for vital plebiscites, but anything you can specify what significance was, that would be a good thing, I accept that. But when you say criteria or guidance, how do you see that? Where would that be in the plan? Is it assessment criteria? Is it in the policy? Is it a schedule? What's the actual mechanism?
I think it would be either or policy or assessment matter. Preferably, my view, a policy sitting underneath, or part of that policy, effectively.
Okay, so, and are there any examples in the current plan or other plans that you know where significance, not just Wahine Tupuna, but other where significance is set out in the policy? Can you give us some examples where you're going to have a look at?
Well, I refer to the natural hazards example as an example.
Can you remind me what that says? In general terms, does it actually say this is significant?
No, yes, please do. it's not black and white. It helps.
No,
it frames.
It's determining significance of natural hazard risk. So it's not about determining the significance of an effect.
Yeah, right.
It's
right.
About determining the significance of risk. And it says the following matters shall be considered. Yeah. And then it says the likelihood of the event. Taking account of existing and proposed reduction measures and people and communities' tolerance. So it doesn't expand on that any much more than that.
So then using the, is that a good example? I mean, it doesn't seem to me to get to where you want it to get to.
Well, my evidence is and almost aspiration would be for Mana Whenua to help us come up with that criteria, because, well, let's step back a bit. What's going to happen in the first resource consent application or when decision makers grapple with this policy? What is the criteria? What are the questions that are going to be asked? And how do Mana Whenua evaluate whether or not an effect is going to be significant?
So I understand that. So currently in the plan, you know, outstanding natural landscapes, a major issue down here. Does the plan specify what is significant in there, or was it done on a case-by-case basis when there's an application of a landscape architect for the applicant says it's not significant, one for the submit says it is significant?
Well, in response to that, in terms of ONLs at least, the council is now going down a path that's directed by the court in response to appeals, to help remove the uncertainty and to help prescribe what is and what is not appropriate by identifying the values within the ONLs.
That's a crucial question,
yeah.
Really. That to me is completely different,
yeah,
than significance and effects.
Yes.
And when I look at the landscape chapters, of which they occur in several places in the plan, I can't see anywhere where they say, well, this is a criteria for determining significance of an effect on those values once they're determined.
No, not in terms of the word significant, because it's been removed from all of the provisions, but in terms of landscape, the operative plan itself in care of the PDP has some pretty substantial and well-understood assessment matters, which should take you down that path of what is not appropriate.
Are they in the plan?
Yeah, the assessment matters.
Where are they?
Chapter 21, I believe.
So just following it through, that might name
the PDP.
Of the PDP, also effectively rolled over from the ODP. And so there's different matters for ONL and non-ONL landscapes. So again, it's providing that. Trying to provide some more prescriptiveness about what might or might not be appropriate, what to look for.
Is an example of that the reasonably difficult to see test?
Yes. Which has now obviously become a strategic policy. But the genesis of that, I understand, is an assessment matter in the ODP.
So just segueing that into the values, I think Commissioner Dawson, she might want to ask some of the questions. That's why I was following up. Whether if the values were specified clearly enough, is that sufficient in your view? values in significance or otherwise can be determined against the impact on the values. It doesn't specify the value of the impact.
I think that would be really helpful. And just an important thinking and behind, or question behind my thinking is this unclarity around, are we just dealing with, or will practitioners be required to deal with one representative of Runanga, or two or three representatives of Runanga, and is there a risk that there could be different interpretations of what is significant, what is a significant effect on mana whenua?
I wonder just whether more because often in the planning profession you'll say it depends on which planner you get. It's all about evaluation and opinion. So I wonder if it's any different. Yeah, you know, I don't want to. So going to the values. So in terms of Schedule 39.6 in the notified version and updated by Mr. Allison and his efforts in terms of he's added a description, but there's also a set of values. Does that go some way to satisfying your concern?
I have to confess I haven't seen Mr. Allison's updated recommendation, sorry. I can have a think about that, though.
They're attached to Ms. Pickard's
to the
summary that she presented at the hearing.
And updated in the second set of legal submissions.
Yes.
But yeah, you might want to come back. Sorry, one final question I've got specifically on, can I deal with specific policy questions or the other one?
Right. Yeah.
Just looking at your suggested, this is paragraph 22 of your evidence in chief, and this comes to the issue of current policy talks about certain activities, and we had quite a long discussion of this about what certain activities was, and I had kind of looked into it whether it was those two policies above which specify a whole lot of activities. But you say, in your suggested wording, recognise that activities identified as known threats in the schedule shall be avoided with significance. So, I can't understand. So when you go to the schedule and you look at the threats, some of them have got a longer list than others. So for example, the first one, number one, I don't know these areas in the other, doesn't include roading, but number two does include roading. So you were saying, in terms of one, roading would never be a threat. Is that how you interpret? Is that how that policy that you recommended would be interpreted?
Yes.
Okay. And then, if going to your previous answers about identifying what's significant, if one of those activities did have a significant effect, by implication, you're saying that effect would have to be avoided and therefore likely the application would be declined.
Yes.
Would you go as far as to say that, and I know avoid doesn't necessarily correlate down to prohibited, but do you think the plan would then need to be much tighter? If there was a significant effect and you want them identified, that you would need to do a whole series of different activity statuses, maybe some non-compliant, maybe even more prohibitive. Is that the corollary?
Yes, I believe so, but again, would want to defer to the Ngāi Tahu experts on the outcomes that are intended by the chapter, and if that's an intended outcome, then in the context of the direction to avoid significant effects, then
I don't expect to go there. But that's your professional view. You'd probably need to have much tighter activity statuses on a number of things.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Smith.
Yeah. Thank you.
I was going to ask you about policy 2.1.4, but I noticed in the latest version it's actually been addressed with the cultural, refers to cultural values rather than the identified areas, so that's quite useful. But I'm just interested in your view of threats. So can you just give me your thoughts on, are the adverse effects that we are concerned about only those from identified threats, or are they from all activities?
Well, that's the question that I pose that I'm not clear on. If we're talking about the schedule.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's right, the scheduled threats, yeah. And so I suppose what I'm asking is, if you're concerned about that question, what are you suggesting or recommending would address that. To do you remove the threats from the do you not identify the threats, or do you identify all the threats and ignore any other impacts? What's your approach to that?
Comes back to my question around, is it complete and is it satisfactory? If according to, or if the evidence of Ngāi Tahu is that it satisfactorily identifies the activities as threats, then keep it, use it to help prescribe what are the known threats. If it's not complete, or if there are gaps, or if there are others, activities out there which may be a threat, then I'm unclear as to how, why you would list some activities.
I used the example last week that potentially the establishment of forestry, for instance, was a threat to a value, but the removal of exotic trees would unlikely to be a threat to a value, which are both forestry activities. Is that is the nature of that threat a bit, I suppose, ambiguous in that case?
Yes.
You, with your experience in landscape and natural hazards that you've talked about, in both those cases, I'm aware that over time information has been refined. You know, that if there is better information on natural hazards, then it is implemented into the plan, into the provisions of the plan, and the same with landscape, as you identified, the court has, I suppose, directed and certainly given direction to be more specific about the values. In this case, do you think it's that's likely to occur as well, that we will get a refinement of the nature of the values over time?
It's a big assumption, but yes, I believe it will happen.
And you talked about the identifying significance. Have you recommended any guidance on how that could be refined, on how do you determine whether something's significant or...
My evidence is that if it's to be done, it should be mana whenua in the first instance to establish or set out what that might look like, and then to be tested by other parties.
So to follow that on, is the who would identify, like when they're assessing the rules, an activity against the rules in the plan, who would actually be determining significance?
And that's exactly the query that I ask. So if we take this as an example, if you take this framework as it is, and then pose it the question, right, I'm applying for a resource consent, the significance policy has to be applied by the decision maker. What is the review process that QLDC and or mana whenua are going to apply? I'm unclear onto what that process is, but there will be a process. And I'm just wondering whether or not we can understand what that process is now and perhaps bring that forward and introduce it into the plan as some guidance.
And do you think the assessment of significance as such rightfully sits with the plan or with the mana whenua? I suppose keeping in mind how a landscape issue might be applied or...
When you say planner, sorry, do you mean decision maker?
Yeah.
It's the decision maker, based and informed by the information that they're going to rely on to make that decision.
And they would...
Unless we talk... a complete side would be an alternative, which would be transfer of powers. Would be the only way I would have thought that a mana whenua expert would be responsible for making that final call as to what is significant.
So what you're suggesting is that the Manawatū would have to be delegated decision-making powers in order to do that?
To make the final call, yes.
That's all for now. Thank you.
No, I think my question's been asked already. Thank you very much, Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. Appreciate your input, as always.
Thank you.
We have the representative, please, of Sustainable by Norton.
Thank you for the opportunity to address you and to put Sustainable Glenorchy's views on Wāhi Tupuna before you. Firstly, I'll introduce myself. I'm Bruce Farmer. I'm chair of Sustainable Glenorchy, and beside me is
Farmer,
F-A-R-M-E-R, and Trish Fraser, who is secretary of Sustainable Glenorchy.
Thank you.
The purpose of Sustainable Glenorchy is to ensure a sustainable future for all people in our community and for those who come after us. We want to improve our community and the environment in a way that is in accordance with the Resource Management Act, and we want to safeguard the social, cultural and economic well-being of our whole community. We advocate for meaningful public involvement in all decisions which affect our community. I would like to congratulate and thank Kaitahu and the QLDC for the changes that they've already made through this consultation process to the original proposal. And that has made our submission shorter and has obviated some of the points that we've previously made. Just on that subject, there's been a huge amount of work done to date by everybody on the subject, and I would like to say that as an individual ratepayer and as a member of a voluntary organisation, the mass of information is overwhelming, and it must be for you too. But for an average citizen to participate in the process fully, it's very difficult and almost counter the objectives of what we're trying to achieve. I don't know how to fix it, but if you do, we'd certainly appreciate your advice on that matter. But at the end, we're really wanting meaningful consultation and participation and involvement in all those decisions which affect the health and well-being of our community. And so we're pleased to be here. And our submission today, as I said, in our submission today, we would like to affirm and support and recognise the cultural values of Wāhi Tupuna and the treaty. Our submission today is in three parts: climate change and power generation, subdivisions, and resource consents and costs. Now, whilst we consider Wāhi Tupuna to be very important, we do think that concerns about climate change should take priority in this instance. And I think that's in line with the values of Wāhi Tupuna. We do not believe that small and community-scale distributed power generation and solar heating should be included in Wāhi Tupuna activities. These activities are to be encouraged in communities, and there should not be any barriers to the implementation such as power and heating. When we look at subdivisions, we believe that any person who has purchased a section in a subdivision should not be subject to Wāhi Tupuna, as the developer of the subdivision would have already been required to identify the values, the traditional settlements, Pā and Mahikai sites, and threats such as activities affecting water quality, earthworks and exotic species. we suggest that only the developer should be subject to wāhi tupuna requirements, and that purchases of the sections should be exempt because it's already been done. And on the subject of resource consent, we are very happy to consult with both iwi, but we believe that this should not trigger a resource consent application with the QLDC if there was previously no requirement for that resource consent. We are against the duplication of bureaucracy and of additional costs to ratepayers, and we would like to have that matter addressed by the Commission. So it's very short. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I thank you very much for the opportunity to address our concerns.
Mr. Farmer, one of the suggestions that Kaitahu made to reduce the regulatory burden of these provisions is to exempt solar panels on roofs. So when you're talking about small and distributed electricity generation, do you mean that, solar panels on roofs, or do you mean microhydros and the like?
I think we shouldn't rule out. The council has declared a ecological and climate emergency. They're talking about innovative management of the area, and some of these provisions are going against what they're saying. We need to change the way that we're looking at the world. There's only one planet, and there's no planet B. So we can't be frozen in the past. We have to recognise it. We have to learn from it and be informed by it. But we can't be frozen by it. And unfortunately, this provision freezes us in a pre-COVID world. We have to be much more adaptable than we've been in the past, and I think that's the basis of the whole of the approach that's being taken now, bringing in all cultures, addressing it, and using all the things and the abilities that we have. We should be allowed to have solar panels on roofs, wind generation, which power generation, which is within the guidelines and the regulations. We should be allowed to have other means, tidal power. We should be allowed also to have a distributed power system and hydro, you know, again, properly regulated and with the right consents. And we should be allowed to have distributed power systems. At the moment, there's been a non-democratisation of our power systems by spinning it off to people who are just trying to rip the system off for corporate greed, and we should be giving that back to the people to allow them to generate power in a sustainable way for a sustainable future.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I can.
You've given us a set of legal submissions. Thank you for pre-circulating them. That's appreciated. We've all read them. How do you wish to proceed?
Thank you. I propose to provide a brief summary of the key points which are made in those submissions, and then I'm happy to take your questions or any questions as they arise as we move through the key points.
Please do. Please proceed.
So first, a brief bit of background about the the submitters, Remarkables Park Limited has land interests in the Remarkables Park Zone and Frankton, and those are substantial land interests. They are affected by the proposed Wahi Tupuna Te Kerikeri, being the area around Frankton and number 24, Kawarau, the river. As addressed in the submissions, that land interest is part of the area which has been withdrawn from these proposed provisions, but is likely to be affected by the outcome of these hearings in the future. Queenstown Park Limited has interests in Coneburn or Queenstown Park Station, which is on the northern end of the Remarkables and the lower slopes of that. That's not the iconic west face of the Remarkables. Their land interests are affected by Kawarau number 24 and Kawarau number 26, which is the mountain on the river. So the original submissions filed by the submitters question the evidential underpinning for the delineation of the Wahi Tupuna overlay and the evidential basis for the extensive list of associated identified threats. Now, there was common ground that there was no material available to justify the spatial extent or the identified threats at the time of notification of the provisions. And I understand that it's been confirmed by the council that the process was that the GIS layer was provided with that mapping and accepted by council with no supporting material, no criteria applied to assess it, or even a narrative around the process which followed. So at the time of notification, council was not in a position to justify the overlay. And for submission, as that's created substantial difficulties with council discharging 32 duty to evaluate the proposal, and particularly in terms of its benefits and costs. The legal submissions address case law in terms of evidential principles. Firstly, the Heybridge decision in the High Court, really confirming quite a fundamental legal proposition that the party asserting the existence of something is the evidential onus of establishing that through probative evidence. I also draw attention to the Ngāi Te Hapū and Bay of Plenty Regional Council decision in the Environment Court, which concerned the resource consent for the abandonment of the wreck of the Rena. And the reason that I've drawn the panel's attention to that decision, paragraphs within that decision, is that it provides a useful exposition of the potential sources of information which can be used to justify or establish a Maori cultural relationship. The third decision which I've drawn attention to is that of the Independent Maori Statutory Board and Auckland Council. Now I imagine Commissioner Hill may be acquainted with the background to that decision, having also sat on the Auckland Unitary Plan Independent Hearings Panel. In my submission, while there are distinctions with the facts of that case, there are also strong parallels with circumstances here where an overlay to recognise sites and places of significance has been introduced without, in my submission, adequate evidential underpinning and the Section 32 consequences of that. Now, having said that, it is accepted that further evidential material has been provided in the evidence of Mana Whenua in relation to the cultural relationship to the district and the identified Wahi Tupuna overlays. However, in my submission, that material doesn't advance or refine the evidential position as it relates to the Wahitopuna of particular concern to the submissives from Marshall's Park, Queenstown Park. And I guess just to tease out that submission a bit further, with respect, the additional material doesn't provide much guidance to the submissives to understanding the underpinnings of the relationship so that they can seek to manage their activities in a way that is respectful to those values. The submissives are left without clarity as to the basis for the identification and the identified threats, and so the provisions don't assist the submitter to understand what it is that is sought. So it appears that the approach proposed by the provisions is a requirement to consult, but the submitters are concerned at the efficiency of that and at the apparent circularity of that process. For those more detailed reasons set out in my legal submissions, the primary submission for Queenstown Park and Remarkables Park is that Council has not discharged its Section 32 obligations in respect of these wahitopuna, at least as they relate to the submitter's land, and the primary relief which is sought is the deletion of those overlays. And in the alternative, amendments to the provisions are sought, and those have also been addressed in detail in the pre-filed legal submissions. So that encapsulates the case for the submitters, and I'm happy to address any questions arising.
Thank you, Mr. Ashton. From my point of view, I'll start with the essential tenet. Is your submission relying on the cases that you've advanced that if there are deficiencies in Section 32 analysis supporting the chapter, that those cannot be remedied by the evidence that we hear? We've already had further input from Mr. Allison, and I anticipate that we're going to have an extensive discussion with Karen Darker about the basis for these provisions. So basically, can any Section 32 deficiency be cured, or is this a once-off? If it wasn't adequate at notification, it's gone.
No, I would accept that further information can be provided to address the evidential gap at notification. However, a thorough re-evaluation of the provisions and what they are seeking to achieve in relation to any further values which may become evident through this process would be warranted, because it's not just the evidential gap which is of concern, it is how that evidential gap has essentially precluded a thorough analysis of the provisions at the time of notification, because those are the provisions that we're here working with. A further point does arise in relation to that, and I should say that I've listened to the recording of Mr. Allison's additional presentation at the outset of these hearings. But if further evidential material is to be provided later in this process, it would seem appropriate that the submitters have an opportunity to comment upon that material through closing submissions.
Thank you. same observation I've made to Mr. Enright, and that is that if you want to apply for leave once you've heard what the Kaitau witnesses have to say, the door is always open. I'm not guaranteeing the answer is going to be yes, but you can certainly make application for that purpose, and we're interested in running a full and fair hearing here, so you won't have to press the door too hard.
Thank you for that indication.
In relation to 3.14, you talk about consents being required frequently, and I was a little unclear. Do you mean frequently on the same site, or across a wide range of sites?
Both on the same site and across a wide range of sites, because we're talking about rural areas which are identified as wahitapona, and there is evidence before the panel of the types of typical farming activities, clearing drains, laying metal for to shore up roads in the winter months, constructing fence lines and tracks, which will inevitably exceed the 10 cubic metre threshold and require consent. And in my submission, it's not difficult to imagine that that would be a substantial number of consents. And further, it would have been practicable for council to have attempted to quantify the number of such consents which would be triggered.
I suppose what I'm wondering is, if you were faced by this, wouldn't the logical thing be for a large rural landholder to get a global consent?
It has been considered by the submitters, but the issue which arises is that the need for these works occurs in the course of farm management. It's not easy to always predict what works will be required. Certainly with some activities, a global consent could be sought, but it's the need for flexibility to undertake activities as the farming need arises and not be drawn into a consent process when using land for its zoned purpose.
Six, the submission you're making, that CIA should be limited to identified wahi tupuna areas, that necessarily assumes that the identified areas capture all cultural issues. Can you point me to any evidence suggesting that that is in fact the case?
No, I cannot assist you further on that point.
Thank you. Commissioner Hill.
Mr. Ashton, I was going to ask you a couple of questions about your submissions or your reliance on the Auckland Unitary Plan recommendation and ultimate decision from the council. As you quite rightly pointed out, I was on that hearing panel, so I've got some background. And I appreciate you said there's some distinctions here, but there are strong parallels. And talking about sort of an insufficient evidential basis, and I really want to point you to comment if you can on the extent to which you think it is relevant that we can look at the unitary plan, open unitary plan model, because you're quite right, the sites of value to Ngāna Whenua there were recommended and ultimately from the council to be deleted, but that was based on that the Ngāna Whenua themselves hadn't selected them, they'd been selected or chosen through the archaeological association. And therefore they hadn't been verified on the ground. As I understand it, the case case is different here. Kamatua and others, we understand, have identified the Wahi Kupuna sites themselves, and we'll go into some more detail with Kāuna when we get there. So are there real parallels here, other than the Unitary Plan panel recommended them be deleted? I mean, how strong
yes.
is the parallel?
The audio visual link was well, the audio was cutting out a little bit there, but as I understand your question, it's how strong is the parallel between the Unitary Plan example and what we're dealing with here. And I accept that there are distinctions in terms of the basis for the overlay in the Auckland Unitary Plan example coming from those archaeological records, whereas here it's been provided directly by Mana Whenua. And also a further distinction which could be noted is that really with sites and places of value to Mana Whenua in the Auckland Unitary Plan context, it seemed that we were really dealing with identified archaeological sites, perhaps with the presence of some physical remain, whereas here we are dealing with a broader Wahi Tupuna concept and a cultural landscape. But having acknowledged those distinctions, I do think similar issues arise in that here the overlay has not been evaluated as against any criteria, which is the same issue that the sites of value overlay in the Unitary Plan context suffered from. So I accept that here the delineation and threats for the overlay has been provided by Mana Whenua, but the step which is missing is the articulation of the values which led to that identification and notification stage, and the assessment of those values against criteria. I would also point you to paragraph 35 of the High Court's decision in relation to the Auckland Unitary Plan, and the quotation there from the council's closing submissions, which actually directly addresses this cultural landscapes paradigm that we're dealing with here. And in that, the RPS is to provide for cultural landscapes to be recognised, enhanced and protected by developing an agreed methodology to identify, record, assess and map the values associated with these landscapes and determine the most appropriate mechanisms. So it is really that process of assessment of the values which in my submission is missing here, and that's the strong parallel.
Mr. Ashton, can I just ask you to confirm that was paragraph 35 of the High Court decision you referred us to?
Yes, paragraph 35. And the other point which is germane to the panel's consideration from that paragraph is that the panel found and the High Court confirmed that there were other provisions within that Auckland Unitary Plan which discharged the duty in terms of recognising and providing for Section 6E matters. And if the panel were to adopt the relief sought by the submitters here, it's my submission that the result would be similar.
Would there be a problem? I understand the point you're making about compliance with Section 6, but would the problem then be a problem that the plan would not comply with Chapter 5, the strategic direction, which clearly anticipates that Wahi Tupuna areas are going to be mapped?
Yes, there would, but that could be rectified by a further process, which is has its foundation in that analysis, which we say is lacking.
Thank you, Commissioner Hill.
But just one follow-up question, Richard. You can correct me if I've misunderstood when you're drawing the parallels and you're talking about the values identification. Of course, here in the Queenstown and in the notified plan, the Wahine Puna sites have got a set of values ascribed to them. What were you suggesting, that the areas were identified and then the values were put in, or the reverse, i.e. that Tangata and others had identified the values and then identified those spatially?
Well, it does seem that the values must drive the spatial identification of Wahine Tupuna, because we're not, at least in my understanding, mapping things for the sake of it. The maps are inherently would have a degree of arbitrariness in them. I guess the point that I'm driving at in terms of the values, and it's perhaps best articulated by reference to Kawarau, the Remarkables, and I accept that there's a column in the schedule which identifies values, and here for, and this is at paragraph 3.7 of my submissions, here the values identified are Wahine Toka, and which means resources, places and sites treasured by mana whenua. Valued places reflect a long history and association. And Mauka, important mountains of great cultural importance to Kaitahu. With the utmost respect to the cultural relationship at play here, those values are expressed in very generic terms. And when you look into them, it is hard for plan users to have an understanding of those values and how they would relate to proposed activities. So my submission is that those values need to be articulated with greater clarity and particularity as they relate to an identified Wahine Tupuna, which must be identified for some particular reason as compared to the rest of the district, which is all regarded as ancestral land. So that's really the issue which we're driving at in terms of values identification.
Just one question. The two environment court cases that you refer us to both relate to resource consents and the evidential basis for granting or declining those resource consents. I'm wondering, is there a different level of evidence that's required at that stage of granting or declining a consent compared with a plan change or plan review, which prescribes areas which then set the basis within which certain rules may be applied? Those rules may or may not require resource consents to be made, and we don't know in the long run those will be considered at a later date for granting or refusal. So is there a difference in the evidential basis in those two situations?
Yes, I think that is a fair comment, that inevitably when faced with a particular proposal, the decision-making body will drill further down into the matters at issue and the evidential basis for various propositions than is appropriate or necessary at the level of plan making. However, I would observe that there seems to be a trend, shall we say, within resource management law and plan making to identify at the time of plan preparation values associated with particular overlays in much greater detail than has been the case in the past. And no doubt you'd be aware of the landscape values scheduling exercise which council has been directed to undertake by the Environment Court in its topic two decision. So while more may be required at a resource consent stage, that doesn't necessarily diminish the standard required at a plan making stage.
But I mean, we have been using this landscape example as a comparison, the outstanding natural landscapes in this district, but that the approach to those has evolved over probably 30 years now from the start of the previous district plan. And so there's been a long maturing of what a plan says, and it's obviously still ongoing. The court's asking for more identification of values in this current process. Whereas possibly we're not at that level of maturity with identification of wahi tupuna areas, the resource consent requirement is just a restricted discretionary in most instances. It doesn't tend to go beyond that, unlike the landscape requirements. I mean, is this something that needs to evolve over time and shouldn't just the sort of baby be thrown out with the bathwater now just because we aren't at the same level the landscapes are at?
There are costs to that approach of, I guess, road testing a proposal which perhaps deserved, in my submission, did deserve further analysis before notification and taking legal effect as these provisions have. And no doubt you may hear reports of how the provisions have been applied in practice since their notification. It's a fair point that we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater, and perfection can be the enemy of achieving things. But my submission here is that the balance is not right between those considerations.
Thank you very much. That's my question.
Any more for any more from Mr. Ashton?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ashton. Much appreciated, and for zooming in. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the ability to appear via this medium.
Can you just clarify one last point? We've got on the schedule Zip Trek this afternoon with your colleague, Mr. Young's submission. Are you going to be coming in for that too? Or is
No, Mr. Yao, Trent Yao, will be speaking to the submission for Zip Trek this afternoon.
All good.
Good.
Thank you very much. Kat, we can sign off, thanks.
Hopefully we can be really brief. I'm Ainsley McLeod, appearing for Transpower, and I'm accompanied today by Mr. Andrew Renton from Transpower. Some of you may have heard from both of us before. I thought it might be useful for Mr. Renton to start out by giving a brief overview about Transpower's assets in the district, and then I'll provide a brief summary of my evidence and take any questions if that works.
Certainly. Thanks for having us here. As you can tell, when you drive between Cromwell and Queenstown, the electricity supply to Queenstown is sourced from the national grid at our grid exit point at Cromwell. Electricity is conveyed into Queenstown over a distance of 70 kilometres from Cromwell to our substation at Frankton, just opposite the airport, via a single double circuit 110 kV transmission line. That is the only electricity supply into Queenstown. Current demand up until COVID was around 70 megawatts at peak, which is getting close to the capacity of the lines. There is embedded generation provided from Aurora and PowerNet, who take supply from our GXP at Frankton, and that comprises of approximately about 4 to 5 megawatts of embedded generation. It's all hydro, micro hydro. There is no other energy sources within Queenstown. Ourselves and PowerNet and Aurora have been working with the Queenstown Lakes District Council to look for options to meet any further growth. The first thing is always energy efficiency, followed by any sort of generation that they can provide. There is sufficient capacity when we're talking about these things. It's the secure capacity. Should we lose one of our lines, it's can the residual line meet the peak winter demand? And there's a range of options that are on the table, from diesel generators to other things. But if you're looking for a renewable power supply with no carbon impact, it is the national grid between here and Cromwell which is supplying the bulk of that energy. Any future increases in demand for things such as electrified transport or otherwise will need to be conveyed in through those assets. And just one final point is in terms of who pays for those assets. The Electricity Authority sets the pricing rules under which Transpower operates. The assets from Cromwell to Frankton, under the beneficiaries pricing approach, is only the beneficiaries pay for those assets. And therefore, all assets from Cromwell to Frankton benefit only the people in Queenstown. And therefore, it is the people of Queenstown who pay our bills for all of those assets, both for any new capital spend and for any maintenance on those assets. That's about it, really. That's all we have in terms of assets here.
So in my evidence, we've included some plans showing where the Cromwell to Frankton A line is and where it traverses three Wahi to Puna areas. I have one correction to those plans, and that's the crossing over the shot over. There seems to be an additional transmission line mapped that does not exist. So it's attachment 4 to my evidence, the second plan. And you'll see that there is one line shown and labelled Cromwell Frankton A, and then there's another red line.
The bottom of the page.
Are you talking about this one?
Okay.
It doesn't appear on your one.
Oh, it's in mine and not yours.
Not there. We've
got
one.
Oh, that's good. Right. You've got the right plan then. For some reason, it's printed on mine. Good news. So my evidence is broadly concerned with how the district plan gives effect to the national policy statement for electricity transmission. And it really only deals in detail with two matters in respect of the Wahi to Puna chapter. The first of which is around achieving consistency between a draft consent order that relates to Chapter 30 and network utilities and Chapter 39. In my evidence, I set out two policies that are included in the draft consent order that effectively foreshadow Chapter 39 happening and have the effect of saying, when it comes to wahi tapuna sites and the national grid, this is the way they're treated, and it's a seek to avoid policy, which is consistent with the terminology used in the National Policy Statement for Electricity Transmission. So in my evidence, I effectively say that Chapter 39 doesn't do quite the same thing, and what the consent order policy perhaps should have done has prevailed in the way it does over a number of other chapters. And I've proposed a solution that isn't as elegant as perhaps the consent order solution might have been, but will achieve the same outcome, to specific to the national grid, providing a seek to avoid policy for new and major upgrades to the national grid. If that makes sense. The second part of my evidence deals with recognised threats, and I've heard a little bit of conversation around those recognised threats this morning. Transpower's submission was concerned that utility activities in general were identified as a recognised threat in some, but not all, of the wahi tapuna areas. Setting aside that inconsistency and perhaps the inability to understand why utility activities were a recognised threat in some but not all, Transpower's submission's view was that utility activities should be deleted. In my evidence, I suggest perhaps a more moderate solution, where there's a distinction drawn between the operation, maintenance and minor upgrade of network utilities, or the national grid specifically, is distinguished from new and major upgrades, such that the recognised threat would sit with new and major upgrades to the national grid or network utility activities, as opposed to the maintenance, operation and minor upgrade of the network utilities that already exist in those wahi tapuna areas. Such an approach would be really consistent with the National Policy Statement of Electricity Transmission that clearly provides a pathway for enabling the operation, maintenance and minor upgrade of the national grid, but imposes greater obligations on Transpower where there is a major upgrade or new development of the national grid. And that's all I've got.
Thank you, Ms. Cloud. The first question I wanted to ask you was about the NPSET.
Mm-hmm.
None of the provisions that you've summarised for our benefit seem to provide for minor federal values.
No, the National Policy Statement for Electricity Transmission is silent on cultural values, which is unusual and perhaps a product of the time at which it was written. The way in which Transpower has elected to deal with that is particularly around policy 4 of the National Policy Statement that talks about needing to the way in which you might use route site and method selection when you're doing new or major upgrades. And in processes where those routes and sites are selected, wahi tapuna and cultural values has become one of those critical matters that Transpower would consider at the outset. A cultural impact assessment would be undertaken, and it's very much been driven by the overarching philosophy of the National Policy Statement of seeking to avoid where possible.
And second point is that I'm looking at this post consent order, seemed to me, as it relates to wahi tapuna, to be seeking to avoid labourage, as you say, seems to be directly inconsistent with policy 3333, which says avoid adverse effects on wahi tapuna. And I wondered, if anyone thought to point that out to the court, because I couldn't see it.
I'd have to do a little bit more research to respond to that. I can't recall if it were pointed out to the court or not.
And even assuming Chapter 30 were confirmed in that sense, the way that the district plan is structured, wouldn't we look to Chapter 3 as the strategic guidance for this and all of the other chapters, rather than across the plan to the energy and utilities section?
My understanding is that text is included in the strategic directions chapter to be clear that no provisions prevail, that they're to be read equally and evenly, and no provisions prevail, or the strategic directions doesn't, there's no hierarchy created in the plan.
Well, I think there's no hierarchy within the strategic directions, but the whole point of having a strategic direction is that it's guiding the rest of the plan, surely. And I can't remember exactly what the text is that's been inserted. I need to look that up. But as I say, I thought that the whole point of having strategic chapters. Thank you, Commissioner.
Somewhere here.
The strategic provide direction for the development of the more detailed provisions. This is in Chapter 3. Strategic objectives and policies may provide guidance on what the related objectives and policies in other chapters are trying to achieve. The objectives of this is the point you're presumably referring to. The relevant objectives and policies of the plan, including strategic objectives, that we considered together, and no fixed hierarchy exists between them. I've asked the council team what the word fixed means in this context, and they weren't able to tell me.
Yes, that was the sentence I was referring to, sir.
Paragraph 44, I've asked you and Transparency Legal Advisors a similar question in previous stages of this district plan. Sort of, isn't there a problem if the NPSET, which doesn't address cultural issues, is competing with Section 6E? Which, when the NPS is supposed to be giving effect to Part 2 of the Act?
Yes, in part, I guess it is a legal question. My understanding is it's very similar in terms of the way in which the NPSET does or doesn't deal with significant Indigenous vegetation and habitats. It's silent on it, but it's not silent on effects on the environment in general. And what I would suggest is that Transparent Practice have read the NPSET more stringently than perhaps it could be.
And lastly, you said, commented that various points that you've talked to Mr. Bathgate, but you didn't say what he was told, what his answer was.
No.
And I appreciate that you might be somewhat reticent about putting words in his mouth and accepting that he and the Kaurunaka team will undoubtedly tell us if they disagree with you. But in order to assist us in understanding your evidence, can you tell us what the answer was?
Well, that's exactly why I've written evidence that way. I don't want to put words in his mouth, and we had a conversation. My understanding was, particularly in respect of the recognised threats, that we agreed that the recognised threats would deal with new activities as opposed to things that were already there in those Wāhi Tapuna areas.
So, as you say, without putting words in Mr. Bathgate's mouth, a measure of acceptance of the position you're advancing to us?
I think so, yes. I provided him with a copy of the consent order. He hadn't seen that, so I think it would be unfair of me to offer his opinion on that, having not had, at the time we had a conversation, he hadn't had the benefit of reviewing that those draft consent order policies.
Yeah, just wanting to clarify, when you earlier on when you were addressing us, you kept mentioning new and major upgrades.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But the suggested amendments you've got here in paragraph 48. Says new and upgraded utility activities. Do you think there's a potential issue with interpretation there?
Possibly. Major upgrades terminology that's used in the national policy statement, and it can be fraught, between what is minor and what is major. It's not particularly useful, but it is what the national policy statement says, and that's why I choose those words.
No, I had the same questions because I haven't been involved in a number of hearings where that became the seminal issue about what was an upgrade, what was major, what was minor, what
yes.
was new.
Yes.
So I understand the concern. Thank you.
Sort of like sort of the acts where everything is replaced by degrees.
Yeah, just one quick question. I understand one of the challenges for our district is one around redundancy and resilience. Obviously, you talked about the one line running into Queenstown. I also understand that there's some, I suppose, objectives to provide an alternate route. If so, what impact, presumably such an alternate route would be a major piece of infrastructure. And if so, what impact would these rules have on the ability to undertake that
If a new route were to be developed, it would be, having had a conversation with Mr. Renton before we arrived here, it would be impossible to provide a new power supply route into Queenstown without traversing a Wāhi Tapuna area. The purpose of the amendments I propose and the seek to avoid, probably the next comment is it would be almost impossible for a new transmission line to not have significant adverse effects, not just in terms of cultural values, but in terms of other values. The amendments I support in my evidence and a seek to avoid policy provide for the best endeavours in terms of avoidance of effects, but still provide a pathway for a planning approval. And I say that because it's as likely that would be a designation as opposed to a resource consent. So the rules may not be critical, but the policy certainly would be.
So
do you want to add?
So we seek to avoid, in that case, equally, would the word minimise or something like that, or I'm just trying to think about how would you do it in such a way that limited the impacts to the greatest extent possible?
I don't support the use of the term minimise. I don't think that's the same thing as seek to avoid. Probably my first point is seek to avoid has its genesis in the regional policy statement policies as well. Seek to avoid, I think, is clearly what it is. It really is a best endeavours kind of expression, if you like. It's saying that there is a pathway and you need to try really hard to not have those effects, but it's also there's still an avenue available to have those effects when you can't avoid having them. Sort of that sounds a bit circular, I guess.
I suppose to give context to that, we undertake when we're planning anything to try and maximise the existing capacity out of any existing assets first, right? Because that's assets that are already established. Try and get the most you possibly can out of them because that minimises the impacts for a start. Seek to avoid, we think, is probably better because if you put minimise in, then that's kind of like you're giving up before you've started. So as an idea of how we go about these things, if and when another line is required into Queenstown, if we can't actually do it any other way, you start out with where is that electricity coming from. So it's either got to come from Roxburgh, North Makariwa, or Cromwell. So that's your three supply points.
So that's what I'm trying to...
And then to get into your region, we would map all of those areas, as Ainsley says, which are seek to avoid outstanding lateral landscapes, Wahitapuna, any known cultural and other sites, great view shafts, and through a process of elimination, you're trying to seek to avoid as many problems as possible while still providing the service you're looking for. And then and only then, you're then seeking to minimise if you can't find a pathway through.
Doesn't it provide some difficulty in that if you go, well, I seek to avoid it, but we couldn't avoid it, therefore the impacts are still significant and, as you said, both not only Wahitapuna, but also landscape effects and those sort of things. I mean, I'm just trying to work out what is the best way to do it in such a way that ensures that the effects aren't only sought to be avoided, but are reduced to the greatest extent possible and the best outcome is achieved.
Yes, well, I think the policies don't stop at the seek to avoid. They say where you can't avoid, there are other things that need to be done as well. So I do think that the policy approach is slightly more nuanced than just seek to avoid, or if you can't, just give up there. I do think there's enough guidance with remedying and mitigating as well.
And that is a conversation that happens with the community, because eventually there is a point where there will be some decisions that the community and Transpower would have to make if we couldn't find any other way and we haven't been able to follow the other pieces in the plan. And that's through the designation process, right? And that's just the challenge we all need to accept and work our way through as constructively as we can.
And the alternative sites provisions under the designation might...
Yes. Yeah, well, there's that, but it's also there's clear direction in the policy in that regard. So that draft consent order policy 32.8.1 talks about how you consider the adverse effects and includes measures to avoid, remedy or mitigate how that might be constrained by the needs of the power line, if you like, the extent to which adverse effects have been addressed through the site route and method selection, and that probably just doubles down, if you like, on the designation tests, opportunities to reduce existing effects and offsetting of residual adverse effects. So there's quite a lot of direction around adverse effects that can't be avoided.
Thank you, that's all. Ms McCall, I just want to follow up on the question of the chair, and it's really, I want to sort of get your view as to whether it is a mistake in 32.8.2 not to exempt Chapter 39, or whether it, when you look at the policy path from the national policy statement and the RPS to the plan, whether it's deliberate or not, there is a policy pathway there that would not exempt mana whenua cultural values from the normal considerations. In other words, keep them apart from that. And the chair's asked you about the national policy statement and how it doesn't specifically hone in on cultural values where it, in that seek to avoid policy. But I've heard you say that it's another effect on the environment, which decisions makers must have regard to when considering adverse effects. But it's sort of, is it right that when you come to the national policy statement, cultural values are bundled into that avoid, remedy or mitigate approach, but they're not elevated above that?
No, they're not elevated in the same way outstanding that landscapes or amenity values in urban areas. Yeah, I know, yes.
Okay, so we've got that.
Yes.
And then when you come to the regional policy statement, again in 4.3.6, the seeking to avoid policy doesn't refer to mana whenua values or cultural values. It talks about historic heritage, but it doesn't, in significant vegetation and landscapes and etc., but it doesn't include mana whenua values. And again, that would seem to me that it gets bundled into the avoid, remedy or mitigate other adverse effects type approach in that policy as well.
Yes.
And that the policy, the statement about policy 4.3.6, which I've just been referring to, prevailing over other policies doesn't include Chapter 2 and the particular policy about mana whenua values.
No, it doesn't.
So it's sort of, I mean, that maybe it's a whole series of oversights, but it doesn't give, whether it's an oversight or deliberate, it doesn't give you clear guidance through either the National Policy Statement or the PS as to where mana whenua values sit in relation to utilities or the national grid.
Yep. I agree with you.
So then you're back down to the plan,
yes.
Really.
Yes, and then I guess it comes to your first question, which is this an mistake or oversight in the draft consent order, or is it deliberate?
Well, not so much in the consent order, but do these series of oversights or series of deliberate pathways mean that the consent order shouldn't exempt Chapter 39 from, or vice versa, shouldn't exempt the national grid or the policy 30 matters
yes.
from 39?
Yes. In my view, the fact that the policy 32.81B(1D) is included. Would indicate to me that it was anticipated that this is the policy that deals with wahi tupuna in Queenstown Lakes District, and it should have the prevail position. But I do accept your point that there isn't the same level of consistency through the policy hierarchy, if you like, as it is, for instance, for outstanding natural landscapes.
Could you have, I mean, could there be coherent policy in the district plan by having wahi tupuna identified in this policy in a seeking to avoid adverse effects, and where adverse effects can't be avoided, remedy or mitigate? Is it inconsistent to have that policy and not exempt 38.282.
Yes.
And the thing is, although we can't change that, you have attempted to do the same
yes.
by putting it into Chapter 39.
Yes, and that was the conversation that I had with the council about it looks to me like we half did the job in the draft consent order provisions, but we didn't quite finish the job properly, and now there's a little bit of retrofitting, and it's not the most elegant solution, but it does the job. My concern was, if you don't have that, then you've got an avoid policy in one place and a seek to avoid policy in another place. And sometime in the future, you go to develop a new national grid line, and both of those policies would apply, and it could have the effect of preventing a new national grid line being built to Queenstown.
Okay, well, that's the crucial point.
Crucial.
What you almost pick up, I think, is might or might not have happened,
mm-hmm.
is a bit irrelevant to
yes.
us.
Yes, fair, yeah.
But an inconsistency in policy direction as a result of a relatively recently recent consent order is more guidance.
Yes, and that's the key issue. It's the inconsistency between Chapter 39 and Chapter 30 draft consent order version. Yes.
I have a follow-up question.
Given
your point that the RPS utility provisions are not, do not expressly prevail over the avoidance policy in 222,
mm-hmm.
does the inconsistency already exist, and even by fixing it, we're potentially shifting the plan into a position where it doesn't implement the RPS? Like, I understand the uncertainty and the unsatisfactory end result from your point of view, but from our point of view, the governing directive is to implement the RPS. If the RPS doesn't exempt utilities, including the national grid, from Chapter 2, on what basis are we doing that?
Yes, well, I guess then it comes down to really starting to read policy 222 and understanding how those values might be identified, as well as, that's where perhaps the second part of my evidence and the recognised threats, and whether in fact we're talking about new and major, and the existing national grid should be enabled, and that kind of thing kicks in a little bit more as well. No, it's not solving the problem, but there's still this draft consent order with a seek to avoid on areas. There's still an inconsistency, isn't there?
I suppose the ultimate thing is, it is hard to imagine any cultural value that is sufficiently flexible that you can put a set of pylons through a way to Puna and not be found to have a significant adverse effect.
Yes.
In the same way that you said that it's hard to imagine that you'll ever not have a significant adverse effect on Owen Hills getting a new line into Queenstown.
That's right, but you could underground the line and avoid the landscape issue, but create a greater cultural impact. So there's a balance as well.
Well, any more for any more?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for attending. We'll adjourn. We're not due back until 1:00.